And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Better stop what you're doing right now and go out and top up your car with gas. Well, better yet, wait till the show is over and then go out and top up your car with gas. Hurricane Rita is pushing its way towards Texas, and in front of it, pushing gas prices up, some say as high as $4 to $5 a gallon. Out in the Atlantic, the leatherneck turtles are affected by the storm, and in D.C. this weekend, well, it's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's been a tough 3 weeks since Katrina stormed into the Gulf Coast, and now we wait to see what Hurricane Rita will deliver. To everything turn, 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 is what the Ecclesiastes were warned. A time for every purpose under heaven. This is tough. A lot of our nation is suffering right now, and I can say in my life this is as bad as it gets, in terms of my own sense or foreboding. And yet, this is the stuff that defines a people and a time and a nation. And it's our time. Today, I want to add some stability in these times of great chaos, because in so many ways, life goes on. Indeed, today's in-depth report on an amazing research effort focused on the gigantic leatherback turtles and their extraordinary journey brings us a global perspective that is important to keep in mind as the debate over global warming and its possible role in the worst hurricane season in many years continues. We'll be talking with Dr. Carlos Drews from Costa Rica, who is heading up the project. In segment 3, we head on out to Washington, D.C., where I'm headed this weekend to talk with Elisa Gravitz, who is co-producing the Green Festival. You know what? Green festivals are feeling pretty darn appealing to a greater number of people each day, particularly as we are faced with reconfiguring whole regions of our nation. Millions of choices will be made. Let a major one be to rebuild green. That will be a focus of this event, and you are invited. So let's get on with the news, and then on down to Costa Rica. So first, the news. It's like a giant game of Captain May I, as people in New Orleans were given the go-ahead to take a few baby steps back into their city, and then were told, no, you may not. With a response from just about every level to Hurricane Katrina, somewhere between inept to criminal, and by the vast complexity of the disruption to towns, cities, and regions along the Gulf Coast, Hurricane Rita, which is barreling through the open Gulf waters, picking up steam and heading for a headlong surge over hundreds of miles of coastal communities, yes, Rita puts all plans on hold. Hundreds of thousands of residents from New Orleans to Houston and Galveston are heading out of town, having learned their lesson from Katrina. However, some unique problems are adding to the mass exodus. Gas availability in some areas is limiting travel, and at the same time, dramatically higher prices, in some cases over $5 per gallon, add insult to injury. Galveston, the site of the worst hurricane disaster, which destroyed much of the city in 1900 and killed 8,000 people, now perhaps may exceed even those historic landmarks. As a result of the century-old storm, the city built a series of levees to protect the island city. Able to withstand 15-foot surges, the prognosis for Galveston is sketchy at best, as Rita, currently rated at a Category 4 and even 5, pushes that limit quite naturally with surges that could reach 20 feet. Therefore, the city is evacuating. Undoubtedly, there is much more to the story of the hurricanes of 2005. In the aftermath of Katrina, initial reports document 44 oil spills within southern Louisiana that resulted in 4 million gallons of crude in one form or another that have entered the environment. The Coast Guard, which is tallying the leaks, says most were caused when either tanks or pipes ruptured. The Coast Guard claims that none of the oil made its way directly into the Mississippi. However, other residents are not quite so sure. The Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality emphasized that some of these estimates are premature. The total amount so far reported factors to about 75% of the oil leaked during the Exxon Valdez incident. Some of the larger spills include 3.78 million gallons discharged by the Bass Enterprise Production Company in Cox Bay, of which 960,000 gallons were recovered, 2 million gallons have been contained, and 982 gallons evaporated. In many cases, the spills mixed with the ocean surges and floods and became part of the toxic waters that are still being analyzed for their potential to cause illness and worse in humans exposed to these waters. The journal Conservation Biology reports that one of the first mass extinctions may be happening with little notice. Insect species may be dying off in record numbers. Some studies estimate that over 44,000 bug species may have disappeared in the last 600 years. Because insects have been only minimally studied and recorded, and with very little current field research monitoring the plight of the six-leggeds, many species have simply disappeared without any real fanfare. Many entomologists are reporting that certain insect species just simply have not been spotted in a very long time. But being scientists, they cannot claim that the animals are extinct. Factors leading to insect extinctions include the fact that many insects inhabit very small niches, which, when they disappear, simply eradicate the associated bugs. The effects of insect extinctions, unfortunately, can begin to be felt in populations of animals whose diets rely on them. This can lead to co-extinctions. At this time, there is really very little that can be done to truly verify what appears to be the beginning of a general collapse of living systems. In a related story, international conservation groups proposed a $404 million effort Monday to preserve frogs and other amphibians whose sensitive porous skins make them particularly vulnerable to even minor environmental changes. At least 43% of known species are declining in population size, including 1,856 that might soon become extinct. The greatest declines are in North and South America, Puerto Rico, and Australia. One of the main causes is a fungus that is spreading, but also habitat loss and degradations, climate change, chemical pollution, non-native species, and over-harvesting of amphibians for food and pets. The International Union for Conservation of Nature and Conservation International are looking to governments, private institutions, and individual donors to assist in funding this project. And next time you go out to buy some kitty treats, don't go shopping for kitty sweets. Biologists say that all felines, from lions to house cats, probably cannot taste sweets because they have dysfunctional copies of the necessary gene. And that's the news. Recently I heard about an amazing research project, visited the website at panda.org, and became instantly caught up in a wonderful opportunity to connect with 11 leatherback sea turtles, the largest reptiles in the world. So now we pick up the story.
I'm very happy that today we're receiving a call actually from Dr. Carlos Drews, who's the regional coordinator for the Marine Turtle Conservation in Latin America and the Caribbean. He's working with the World Wildlife Fund. He's calling us from Costa Rica. Dr. Drews, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you. Yes, I'm very pleased and all yours for this program.
Thank you very much. Well, your focus, I'm sure you have a lot of experience in many aspects of marine ecology and marine biology, but right now you're focused on turtles. That is really your expertise. And very specifically, what we're going to talk about today are the leatherback turtles. Why don't you give us a sense of these animals, describe them, and then let's talk a little bit about their behaviors and why this actually affects their survival and what how this actually directs your project.
Leatherback turtles are the largest reptiles on Earth at the moment. They have not been the largest always over the time of evolution, but today they are, and they are also the largest of all sea turtles. They can travel thousands of kilometers from the nesting grounds, usually in tropical areas, to the foraging grounds in temperate waters where jellyfish is abundant. Now, they do feed mainly on jellyfish. And these animals come back for nesting after a 2.5 to 4 years traveling tour on the Atlantic side or on the Pacific Ocean, and lay in the order of 80 eggs on each nest. They may lay 6 or 7 nests in total in one given season. And that's the reproductive effort for that particular season. Then they'd return again to the foraging grounds in distant waters. This means, of course, that the habitat requirements involves a whole number of nations, starting from the nesting sites as such, but then all the way across the waters that take them to the foraging grounds. For example, turtles nesting in Costa Rica can go as far north as Nova Scotia in Canada, or even the coast of Wales. Some turtles may travel from the Guyanas all the way to the western coast of Africa, and turtles nesting in the Pacific coast of Mexico can go all the way down to northern Chile. So any conservation effort has really to encompass the whole range of habitats necessary for these animals, and consequently a great number of nations that must be involved in this shared responsibility for their survival.
Yes, it's an enormous project. There's two real different populations, the Pacific turtles and the Atlantic turtles. Their status right now is quite a bit different. Let's talk about the Pacific, which apparently are very endangered right now.
The leatherbacks of the Pacific, of the Eastern Pacific, are the most critically endangered sea turtle population worldwide. They have declined over the past 18 years of something in the order of 90 to 95% at a main nesting site in Mexico called Mexiquillo Beach. We used to have 1,800, 2,200 females coming ashore on every nesting season. In the year 2003, when I visited this beach, only 6 females came ashore. And that's the extent of the decline also in the second most important nesting site, which is Costa Rica. So we are really looking at a species that is on the brink to extinction.
Yes, that is critical when you have 6 nesting females that you're able to identify. I imagine, therefore, that in that situation, the eggs are being gathered and protected?
Not necessarily. That particular beach is well protected, so it was not necessary to move eggs. And conservationists today are hesitant to move eggs unless it is absolutely mandatory, because the nest is doomed, for example, because of flooding or imminent poaching. That's because the hatching success tends to be higher, of course, if we leave the nests alone than if we put them in a hatchery. But yes, essentially every egg counts for the leatherbacks of the Eastern Pacific today.
Now let's switch over a little bit eastward towards the Atlantic Ocean and talk about the Atlantic population.
The Atlantic population is more numerous at the moment, and we have a variety of scenarios. In some beaches, they are declining still, whereas at other sites, they are starting to increase the numbers. So overall, we have a mosaic of scenarios suggesting that they are better off than their Pacific counterparts. But given the quantification of turtles dying, for example, in the longline industry, we feel that the Atlantic leatherbacks are undergoing extreme pressure from the world fisheries, and that we need to do something about it. So the idea behind engaging immediately in the Atlantic Ocean, even if we have set as a priority the leatherbacks of the Eastern Pacific, is to prevent that dramatic decline from happening, and ensuring that these populations in the Atlantic will be stable or increasing for the years to come.
Now, also for the listeners, let's paint a picture of this animal, because this is a very unique sea creature.
The leatherback turtles are most unusual. They don't have a hard shell, for example. They are all kind of grayish or gray-blue. That's the color of the skin, with some pink and white patterns underside their skin and under the flippers. These animals have an extremely streamlined body design, and they can travel at about 5 meters, 7 meters per second when they are riding the sea currents. That means they are not just passively being taken by the sea currents, but they are actually using their flippers to increase a little bit their speed as they move along. They are amazing divers. They can go as far down as 1,800 meters at times. So that's, I think, the record dive that has been recorded ever.
That's extraordinary.
They have to adjust to the increasing water pressure as they dive under, and they are very, very well adapted to an ocean environment. Well, the males are basically the same size as the females, but they have a much longer tail. That's the way to tell them apart, relatively easy. But as it turns out, we don't see any males coming ashore. The males never return and never leave the water again after they are born. They only come relatively close to the shore to mate with their females, but it's only the females that will be seen by the tourists and the scientists alike when they go to nesting sites.
One of the amazing aspects of the leatherback turtle is the fact that it's a very large animal.
These animals can measure up to 1 meter 80 and weigh in the order of half a ton. That's 500 kilograms, 600 kilograms. They're very large, and that size really helps them make use of habitat in cold waters, because the relationship between the water, the body surface, and the body volume by the sheer size of the animal is convenient. They can maintain the water, the heat of their bodies and still be able to forage in waters just below 10 degrees centigrade.
Mm-hmm.
That's very amazing for a reptile, really, and scientists are starting to believe that the leatherback turtle has a system whereby she can generate a little bit of her own body heat through metabolism in a way similar to some of the most evolved dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's now take a look at the life cycle. The animals that you're studying start out on the Atlantic coast of South America. That's primarily where your work is focused. They lay their eggs. Let's talk about the female, because this is where this story becomes so extraordinary, because once they finish that mission, that is the laying of the eggs, then they take off on this extraordinary journey. Give us some highlights of what you're discovering about their life from that point on.
Yes. We have recently started to understand the movements of leatherback turtles, particularly in the central and southern part of the Atlantic, where they were really, by and large, unknown, by using state-of-the-art satellite radio transmitters. These transmitters are the size of a mobile phone. They are fitted to the turtle using a harness, a system of strings and an attachment system to the leatherback that does not harm them. And the transmitter will tell you the location of the turtle, the diving depth, and the speed of movement, as well as the water temperature, for anything in the order of a year to 2.5 years. And that's very precious information. We have seen turtles traveling from Panama all the way to the coast of the eastern coast of the United States, reaching nearly Canadian waters now. There is one. Another one was in New Orleans, just offshore New Orleans, at the time when the Hurricane Katrina hit that area. And we see from the movements of the turtle in the water that she was going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, basically taken by the incredible force of this hurricane in an area of about 100 kilometers in various directions in a very uncoordinated way. When the hurricane passed, she finally moved in a straight line towards the peaceful waters of the shore. That's quite extraordinary. I don't think we have seen that ever happening and being documented
That's
before.
Amazing. Mm-hmm.
Then we have another very unusual turtle that was tagged off the coast of Uruguay from a fishing vessel when she was caught in the long lines of that particular fishing vessel. But she was lucky. There was a conservation group called Carumbe on board of that vessel, and they fitted this turtle with a transmitter. She's now moving north and has covered nearly 3,000 kilometers in Brazilian waters, and we anticipate that this turtle will continue traveling eastwards towards the shores of Gabon and may eventually lay her eggs next year during the next nesting season in Gabon. So African turtles traveling to Latin America really shows how conservation of marine turtles is a transcontinental challenge.
It seems as if the turtles tend to be very individuated in terms of their migratory paths. Any idea, is that correct, or do they seem to follow patterns? What can you tell us?
Well, we do see very individual tracks at times, and previous research in the northern Atlantic has also suggested kind of a spaghetti pattern across the Atlantic Ocean. They seem to have individual preferences for where they want to forage. But when you finally look at the locations where they end up foraging, they tend to be all convergence zones where the abundance of plankton and in particular of jellyfish is very high. So we can look at satellite information, oceanographic information, and then anticipate roughly where the turtles will end up once they finish the amazing trip from the nesting sites to the foraging grounds. We can also see that some of these turtles follow underwater ocean ridges, where again you have upwelling of very nutrient-rich water reaching the water surface, and again the plentiful water, plentiful in jellyfish. That's what makes good foraging habitats for the turtles.
Do you know if they tend to travel in groups, or is it more individual?
They do not. They do not congregate or coordinate their movements. They are very individual animals. The only time when they kind of gather is when they are ready to lay their eggs, and that's when they come close to the shore. And if we're talking about the females returning to a nesting site, that's when they encounter a very high density of males. But for these animals, we don't speak of an actual social bonding, kind of group living. It's just the coincidence, the coincidence in space. If that's where the nesting beach is, that's where we're going to meet, and that's where we mate, and then we all depart again and do our individual lives as usual.
Now, also, I'm just curious, are you finding that these animals are coming back to a very specific beach, or is it more generalized?
The animals that we are tracking so far have not returned yet to the nesting sites. We will have to wait another 2.5 years to see that happen. But we know from the previous studies that they do tend to be faithful to the beach where they were born. Notwithstanding, we have already documented cases of turtles, for example, nesting in French Guiana during one nesting season and then going to Trinidad during the next nesting season. Mm-hmm. And some turtles nesting in Costa Rica may end up nesting in the eastern Antilles in the Caribbean during a subsequent nesting season. So the movements are not as predictable as it is, for example, for hawksbill turtles, who are extremely faithful to the beach where they nest season after season.
And then also, just in terms of the hatchlings, has anyone been able to study sort of their paths? I mean, is it an instinct to head to certain areas? And I mean, just curious what we know about how they managed to learn this process.
Well, we are all very curious about that, and this is one of the great mysteries of sea turtle biology. It is very, very difficult to follow hatchlings. They have not been tracked to any degree. The size, the sheer size of the animals does not permit us fitting them with any transmitters that will last for a long time. So we have a great mystery here, and particularly for leatherbacks, for which the juvenile stages are very, very little understood. We don't know where they tend to be. I think there are only 4 records worldwide of juvenile leatherback turtles being found. So we have a great black hole of information here, a great mystery. Speculations suggest that they orient themselves when they return to the nesting beach using the coastline patterns, but maybe also geomagnetic cues as well as the stars. These are the typical cues that migratory species utilize across a different range of animals. So we think that turtles are probably using the same cues, but yes, a big mystery is still here.
When we return, we find out just what these grand creatures must face to fulfill their ancient place in the grand web of wonder, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's a 3-year open ocean journey from South America to the northern coast of North America, then across the open seas to the coast of Africa, then back again across the Atlantic to mate, then lay eggs, and begin again this cycle. It's an ancient wonder, millions of years in the making, just one of the grand stories of our world. But will it too disappear into the mists of history? We explore more the story of the leatherback turtles when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wildside News. And now, the story of the leatherback turtles continues.
Well, now let's talk about really your work in terms of trying to utilize your research to help these animals survive, because obviously there's a series of dangers that are put upon them. Why don't you outline some of the main threats to these animals?
Okay, there is a long history of egg consumption in Latin America. These eggs of marine turtles in general are supposed to have aphrodisiac properties and are therefore consumed very widely, both in the Pacific and in the Atlantic coast. That has meant that for many, many years we did not see any hatchlings of leatherbacks going into the water and eventually growing to become adults. So we have a problem right there already. The adults that we have are just limited in number, and there is not a big, large number of juveniles growing. So every egg counts today for the leatherbacks. But the other big pressure, and which is acknowledged as the most important threat to marine turtles worldwide, is the mortality as incidental catch in hooks and nets of the artisanal and industrial fisheries. And it is this threat, which we call bycatch, the one that we hope to address through our efforts here in the Atlantic Ocean. When we learn about the tracks of the turtles as they migrate, we will be able, hopefully, to identify hotspots of interactions between turtles and fisheries, and eventually be able to design when and where there should be closures for fisheries to permit the passing of the turtles towards their foraging grounds or the arrival of turtles towards the nesting grounds. So that's one definite way of mitigating the threat of bycatch. But then there are other ways. There's a fascinating hook that has been recently designed called a circle hook. The circle hook has the nice property that it catches fish, but it does not catch as many turtles as the classical J-shaped hook that is used worldwide in the longline industry. And we are moving forward through a voluntary adoption program for circle hooks with the longline industry in various countries in Latin America. And I think there is a very promising avenue here to reduce the pressure of mortality as incidental bycatch for the leatherbacks.
Mm-hmm. Now, this brings us actually to a very interesting aspect of your work right now, and that is the fact that your people who have access to the Internet are now able to literally watch the movement, that is to say, the migration of these animals from their breeding grounds out into wherever they head, some heading north, some into the eastern coast of the United States, some into open seas. And it's a fascinating thing to watch, because you have identified or actually put tracking devices on 11 different leatherbacks, females, and they are very unique in terms of their personal migratory patterns. That's just so interesting.
Yes, we are very, very excited about this opportunity, and in fact, the credit for this is the willingness of scientists and conservation groups across the Atlantic Basin to collaborate with World Wildlife Fund on this endeavor, and to provide the data so that we can portray it online for everyone to see. So we're starting to see interesting patterns, yes. Just as you say, there are many individual decisions that these animals take. The ones that left Panama, for example, went in various directions. One went between Cuba and the Dominican Republic, whereas others decided to go north, east of Haiti and between Puerto Rico and the Antilles Islands. Another one decided to go west of Cuba, just north of the Yucatan Peninsula, into the Gulf of Mexico. And this is the turtle called Fermina, who was very close to New Orleans at the time of the hurricane, Romin Romana, another turtle from Panama, ended up as well very close to New Orleans as we speak. And we have a turtle that we call Marina. This is the single turtle that was fitted with a transmitter offshore Uruguay. And she again is revealing interesting associations with the underwater ocean ridges that are located in the area. So when you zoom into the track of Marina, you will start to see that there is an association of her movements with some of the very nutrient-rich waters that these seamounts generate underwater. So, yeah, we're very excited, in particular because we have another team of scientists in Gabon who will be deploying transmitters the end of this year from nesting females there, and we wish to see where these turtles go, and we have, of course, already an idea and suspect that they will go to feed in the waters of Argentina and Uruguay mainly. Cold waters, very nutrient-rich, which again illustrates the importance of conservation efforts in Gabon, in Africa, being complemented by an equivalent reduction of bycatch mortality in Latin American shores.
Part of the story as well is that not all the turtles survive, and that's been demonstrated already in your project through the satellite transmissions.
We have a sad story indeed. The turtle Kawana was fitted with a transmitter in Suriname and shortly after died in what we suspect must have been a gillnet. The turtle's records show that she was held underwater for about 9 hours on her final dive, and that tends to suggest that she definitely got entangled in one of the gillnets that is one of the many thousands of gillnets that we see relatively close to the shore in the Guyanese waters. So this turtle, and we finally recovered the body and the transmitter, which we will be able to fit to another turtle on another occasion, is revealing exactly what this project is about. This is the main threat to turtles, the nets, the hooks in the water. They are not intended to catch turtles. It is a pain for the fishermen when they have a turtle this size in their gear. The gear tends to get destroyed. No one really wants to catch these turtles. So when we look for solutions to the problem of bycatch, we are looking for a solution not just for the turtles, but also for the fishermen. So we tend to see that there is great buy-in on the sides of the fishermen to look for these alternatives, as long as we provide alternative gears or alternative sources of income for the time when fishing in front of a nesting site is not the thing that we wish to see happen.
That's an amazing story. Now, in terms of the bycatch, when a boat picks up a turtle, what do they do?
It very much depends on the gear that the boat has, but when we're talking large fishing vessels with long lines, a long line is basically long, when I say long, 70 kilometers up to 100 kilometers long line held on the water surface with buoys, and then another series of lines with hooks hanging down along this incredible distance, maybe something in the order of 10,000 hooks for the big industrial longliners. When we're talking a long line, and the long line is being pulled on the boat and the catch is being taken, when there is a turtle, generally the first thing to do is to cut the line and let the turtle go, if she's still alive, with the hook in her mouth or in the esophagus, in the throat. That can be a lethal injury for the turtle, and she will eventually die. That's the usual thing. But with this new approach, circle hooks, we train also the fishing crews how to handle the turtles and provide gear such as nets, large nets that you can use to scoop the turtle out of the water and put her on board of the vessel, and then resuscitation techniques, de-hooking techniques, just to make sure that before the turtle is released, she is already in relatively good shape. And that is also reducing a considerable proportion of the mortality associated to bycatch.
What estimates are there about the mortality rate for caught turtles?
It is a very complicated question indeed. But what we have is a global estimate of 50,000 leatherbacks being caught every year in the longline industries of the world. Not all of them die, and that's the number that, as I say, is complicated to obtain. But anything in the order between 10 and 20% is probably realistic to assume that will die, because the turtles drown if they have been held underwater for quite some time. So we're talking here a very serious problem. In fact, the large decline of the Eastern Pacific leatherbacks is attributed to extreme high bycatch in longlines and gillnets in northern Chile and offshore Peru, which is very distant from the place where we actually record the decline, which are the nesting beaches in Mexico and Costa Rica. So the pressure is there. It is acknowledged as to be the main threat to marine turtles worldwide, and we think it needs to be addressed by government and industry alike.
I noticed, is it Aitkana, A-I-T-K-A-N-A, one of the turtles, that apparently seems to be heading out into open waters. That, to me, is a fascinating thing, the idea that this turtle can just have free range of the Atlantic. To me, that's romantic, and I think when people begin to really sense the life of these animals, and also the way in which they individually determine where to go, that's a very powerful image to me.
Yes, thank you. I see it that way as well. This turtle, Aitkanthi, may eventually reach the west coast of Africa. And here she will be facing serious challenges from the longline fleets and the gill nets. So we hope that Aitkanthi may be able to return to French Guiana to nest 2.5 years after. But it was amazing how fast she crossed the Atlantic. Mm. Now she has covered nearly 4,000 kilometers in a month and a half at the most. So it is tremendous the distance that these animals can develop when they ride the right sea currents and when they make the right choices, which is what these turtles have evolved to do.
Now, do they actually feed while they're traveling?
Not much, really, but until they get to the abundant feeding grounds, zones of upwelling associated to ocean ridges or convergence zones where cold water meets warm water, areas like that. So usually they will just travel until they get to these feeding grounds.
Let's talk about the males a little bit, too, and maybe we don't have as much research, but are they as well migratory?
The males have exactly the same nutritional needs as the females. They have to go back to the cold, temperate waters where jellyfish are abundant to spend the remainder of the year. And then they do come back to the tropics probably at about the same time as the females do. But they need to have all the fat stored that will enable them to do these amazing migrations to the warm waters of the tropics, which are much less plentiful in terms of jellyfish. So during the nesting time and the mating time, the males and the females probably do not feed a great deal.
Let's also talk about where people can go to follow this emerging story that will go on for years now.
We published a report last year illustrating the economic value of marine turtles alive in various places of the world, and the ecotourism industry is definitely adding great value to turtles in communities that have decided to conserve them and to use them as a tourist attraction, such as the case, for example, in Costa Rica, in Tortuguero. That's a very well-known place to go and see turtles. That's on the Caribbean side of Costa Rica, and you can see leatherbacks in the first half of the year in the Tortuguero area. Of course, in French Guiana and in Suriname, there is it's one of the most important nesting sites in the whole Atlantic Ocean for leatherbacks. People can visit the nesting sites and be guided and shown these amazing reptiles. Then on the Pacific side, Playa Grande in Costa Rica is again one of the places where people can try to see the leatherback turtles, but I must say, with the decline that this population has undergone, when you get to the nesting site, your chances of actually seeing the leatherback turtle are small. And this illustrates how a community that lives from ecotourism and uses the turtle as the main tourist attraction can be affected in its livelihood by the decline of this species. So who bears the responsibility and the liability for this community whose livelihood is endangered if the turtle disappears? Is it going to be the fishing industry? Is it going to be the nations where most of the bycatch is happening? We have great challenges here also in international policy work. As you can see, as soon as we start to talk, livelihoods depend on the existence of turtles in some places.
Yes. Now, your work is being overseen by the World Wildlife Fund, as well as some of the sponsors of the Tortugas Marinas and Caribbean Conservation. And you can follow the movements of the turtles online by going to panda.org And there you can literally tap into each one of the individual turtles and follow what's going on with them. It's absolutely fascinating. For people who wish to learn more, and as well, you know, really we have to bring this out to a much larger realm, where do you think the most important areas for people to focus in terms of making differences are?
People can contribute to the conservation of marine turtles in various ways. One is, of course, your behavior anytime you go to the beach, how you dispose of the garbage, because plastic bags that end up in the world's oceans are causing some mortality to the leatherbacks because they confound them with jellyfish, and that causes, of course, a lethal obstruction of the in the stomach area and can kill them. But there are other ways to contribute. Traveling to places where leatherbacks are nesting and where communities have decided to protect them is adding to the value of the live turtle, the turtle alive. Any expenses in accommodation, in food and transportation at these local sites where marine turtle conservation is happening is key for society to learn about the economic and socioeconomic positive impact that having marine turtles around can mean. So I think these are two ways. Of course, people can also look for conservation organizations. There are national conservation organizations in the United States, in Florida. There are groups that are extremely active, and they need financial support. So that's just one more way to contribute to marine turtles. And we're now starting to explore how, from the consumer end of things, when people make their choices as to what fish they should buy, we hope that we will have a system in place in the future where people can buy turtle-friendly tuna, for example, or turtle-friendly mahi-mahi in the supermarkets that will ensure that the fleets that are fishing that particular tuna or mahi-mahi are making all efforts that we know are possible to do today to reduce bycatch mortality.
Sort of like in the wood industry, we have the FSC certification that says that the wood is not impacting tropical rainforests.
Sure. The Marine Stewardship Council, which is the marine equivalent of the FSC, the MSC certification, is already a system in place. It's only that most of the fisheries that have an impact on sea turtles have not been as yet certified, and they face additional challenges, not just the reduction of mortality in turtles per se, but also the implementation of quotas, management systems, etc. So we have a big challenge ahead, but we see where the tunnel is leading us, and we can start to see the line at the end.
Dr. Carlos Druz, who is the regional coordinator for the marine turtle conservation in Latin America and the Caribbean, is working with the World Wildlife Fund. Now let's expand this out and go a little bit personal, because there are some people who would say, and I'm sure you hear this once in a while, and who cares about these things? Why is this important? I mean, there's so many animals. You're catching 50,000 a year in the nets. That means there must be a lot of them out there. Tell us why this is important from your perspective.
Yes. Well, marine turtles are all endangered, and some worms, nematodes, or small plant species are also in danger. So the question is quite legitimate. Why bother so much about marine turtles? What is different? Well, marine turtles are storytellers. I think that's my personal take on the turtles and why the turtles is because they have, of course, a right on their own to be part of the world's biodiversity, and if we're responsible and if we are the custodians of that biodiversity, we have to do something about turtles. But turtles tell us a story about the relationship between society and the oceans. If you think of the time when Columbus was roaming the waters of the Caribbean, when they got close to the shore or in the Bay of Havana in Cuba, they were hitting turtles permanently with their vessels. It was a thump that was hitting the vessel permanently because there were just thousands of them close to the nesting sites. If we ever see the turtles recover to the numbers that used to be around here 500 years ago, we will have solved most of the problems that have to do with society's relation with the oceans. We will have addressed the sustainability of fisheries, the selectivity of fisheries. We will have addressed coastal development, the tourism industry, for example, and how it can impact nesting sites will have been taken care of. We will have addressed the need to conserve the coral reefs because that's where the food of the hawksbill turtle is found mainly. So if there are hawksbill turtles in abundance, we will have healthy coral reefs for sure. So I think the marine turtle is a very powerful vehicle for ocean and marine coastal conservation in general. It's also very powerful for communication purposes. As you have seen, I mean, people do get attracted to the turtle, and now through the website they can see the movements in the Atlantic Ocean. People just think that turtles are a charismatic species. They are innocent creatures. I look at them as an animal that has been doing going about its business for 100 million years in a kind of innocent way. They are not fierce predators or anything. And all of this kind of appeals to the public. How can these animals go extinct in front of our eyes if they are doing no harm to anyone? I think it's of course a simplistic way of looking at it, but they have such great appeal. And communications is a powerful strategy to raise awareness, not only at an individual level, but also at the level of governments. I do hope that when government officials learn about our project and about this incredible shared responsibility that comes out of these tracks that the turtles draw across the Atlantic Ocean, we will be in a much better position to reach policy that will bring the turtles back to where they were at Columbus times.
Well, your project is one of many, many, many significant efforts to try to keep these oceans alive. I'd like to get your perspective on what you feel in the larger spectrum is going to be required to bring our oceans back, because at this point, all indications are that they're being severely impacted in ways that most people aren't aware of.
Yes. Perhaps the main impact on the world's oceans has happened with the advent of industrial international fisheries. We are now really in a position to take incredible numbers of fish. Also, the problem is that the gear for fishing is not selective. So the bycatch, anything that you catch that you did not intend to catch, is for some of the fisheries a ratio of 1 to 10. That's to say, for 1 kilogram of shrimp, you throw away 9 kilograms of anything else, fish and other sea creatures. And that discard is just unbearable. That will never be sustainable for the world's oceans. So I envision that the world's fisheries will become more and more selective, that we will have better systems in place to ensure that the take is not harmful to the population as a whole. That means that the fisheries are sustainable, that we do not use gear that destroys the ocean floors as it is dragged over the seamounts where some of the most unique ocean creatures are abundant. And in that way, perhaps, we may be able to preserve the ecosystem as a whole. So when we say ecosystem as a whole, if that's what we want to preserve, our approach to fisheries should be ecosystem-based and not just the species that is fished and make quotas and take for that particular species, but also think of the impact that that fishery is having on the whole network, the feeding network, and the whole ocean community. And that's a big challenge. But scientists are helping. We now have much better models of ecosystem-based fisheries, and some of the fisheries in Latin America are receptive to this new approach, ecosystem-based.
For people who wish to assist in that larger process, what would you recommend?
When people learn about the impact that the fisheries have on the product that you have on your plate, I think from a consumer end, we will be in a much better position to exert pressure on those practices that are definitely detrimental to the ecosystem. So we are urging the public to learn more about the implications of eating that particular choice of yours from the marine environment for your lunch. And then make choices. Consumer choices are the biggest power in the world's markets at the moment, and we firmly believe that an informed public can make a difference.
Well, that's exactly what we've tried to do during these two segments on the Wild Side News. Dr. Carlos Drews, I want to thank you so much for adding your voice to the Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
It was my pleasure, and I do look forward to provide additional information that the public may have. They can write to me. There is a link at our website at panda.org. If people have any questions, we are all yours.
Thank you so much.
The signs are everywhere. We are dramatically changing life on planet Earth. And planet Earth is dramatically changing our life on Earth. Do we need to call a truce? Can we? When we return, it's over to the nation's capital where a lot of people are getting together to forge a beginning. When your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
It's going to take a long while and lots of work to rebuild the Gulf Coast. Some would say this is a unique opportunity to put into place the green concepts for building, business, and a sustainable new way on a very large scale. This weekend, in D.C., the nation's leading green advocates and businesses are converging to build their community, which holds many answers to a sustainable future, a chance that hopefully will never be forced on us again. It's the Green Festival when we return with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
It comes at a most fortuitous time when thousands in America are facing rebuilding vast stretches of the Gulf Coast. The Green Festival in Washington, D.C. will be filled with great ideas, people, and products that should be part of the reconstruction. It's green building, green business, and more. If you happen to be in D.C. this weekend, a busy weekend indeed in the nation's capital, this is what you will find.
I'm going to be off in Washington, D.C. this weekend for a series of events, and one of those that I'm so fortunate to have occurring over the September 23rd, 24th, and 25th is the Green Festival that's happening at the Washington Convention Center. And to tell us all about the Green Festival is one of the co-producers of the show, Alisa Gravitz, who is with Co-op America. Alisa, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Oh, thank you, Sidney. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, first of all, let's talk about what the Green Festival is, and then I'd like to learn about Co-op America and as well the other major sponsor of this global exchange. Let's start out with the Green Festival itself. Give us some details.
Well, the Green Festival is a two-day celebration of what's working in our communities around the country. It is all about what is the growing green economy, who are the businesses, who are the leaders, what role do we all have in creating a green economy, which, when we say green, green means safe, healthy communities in a strong local economy. To us, green is a color of hope, of social and economic justice, and of ecological balance. So we have this two-day festival in the convention center where we welcome everyone to come from around the country to learn about what's working in terms of energy-efficient technology, renewable technology, green buildings, community building, what role does youth have in creating a better future, what can parents and kids and families do together. So, you know, no matter who you are, you live somewhere and you want a safe, healthy, thriving community, so come to the Green Festival and learn how to do that in a way that's just and sustainable.
Well, why don't we just go ahead and talk a little bit about how people can find out about this, and also if they wish to attend, what they can expect to pay to get in.
Sure. Well, if you want to learn more about the Green Festival, come to our website. It's www.greenfestivals.org. That's an S, so it's greenfestivals.org. And you'll see everything that's going on over the weekend. We have over 125 visionary speakers, national, international, and local. We have over 350 exhibitors showing the best in green technology, green building. Folks can come by and do their, start their holiday shopping and make it green. There's a fair trade pavilion that shows how fair trade is connecting communities around the world and making sure that people have a living wage. Plus, the fair trade dark chocolate there is just phenomenally good. It's organic. It's fair trade. It's dark chocolate, so it's high in antioxidants. It's just fabulous. We have, of course, live entertainment, musicians from around the community. We have a food court. Every festival has to have its food court, but this is all organic food court. We have some terrific kids' activities. We have a rolling rainforest. We have authors who have written about environmental subjects for kids reading their books. In fact, we're kicking off the entire Green Festival with a parade of kids that have made some beautiful peace doves that are like 50 feet long, and they're going to parade around the convention center with their families and start the festival off on Saturday morning. So it's just a great way to remember why we're all doing this for our future and for our kids. And we have a film festival where we're going to have some premieres, including the Dirt on Farmer John, which is all about agriculture as it is and agriculture as it can be, which is sustainable. And so it's going to be very exciting. We're also getting a sneak preview of the new film on Walmart and all the problems that Walmart is causing in our communities around the country. So it's just from every angle, it'll be practical ideas, everything from green careers to being able to exercise your body and soul. We have free classes in yoga and movement and Tai Chi. And then, of course, you know, you have to celebrate it all. We have an organic beer garden, so there's something for everybody.
It's an extraordinary vision of really what is making up the best of our community, the vision of a peaceful and sustainable world. In terms of the extent of people involved in these ideas, this concept of the Green Festival and your partners and friends, how would you estimate how many people across the country are involved?
Well, this is an extraordinary movement. It's large and it's growing. We have done some polling, and some of our allies have done some polling, that actually 1 out of 4 Americans already subscribe to the idea of a just and sustainable future and are doing something actively about it. They may be recycling. They may be buying organic food. They may be doing socially responsible investing. They may be supporting political candidates in their community that share their vision. They may be writing letters to the editor and supporting programs like yours. And so there's like everybody, there's so many people that are already doing a piece of it. And one of the things that the Green Festival does is bring everybody together so we can say, there's a lot of us. Let's link arms and be ever more forceful and positive and hopeful and invite others to come and join with us. So that's one of the jobs that the Green Festival has, is to say, look, there's an awful lot going on already. We're proving that these things work. The organic food is healthy for the farm workers. It's healthy for the soil, and it's more delicious. Those of us who are commuting already by bike or electric scooter are getting healthier exercise, and we're saving on the huge gas prices that people are experiencing right now. Renewables is the way to go into the future so that we can avoid the future Katrinas and not have climate change cause devastation to more and more communities like the heartbreak we're seeing in Louisiana and the Gulf Coast right now. So there's just so many ways we can all connect on the solutions and be ever more powerful together.
One of the aspects of this is the fact that for some reason we seem to find ourselves talking about red states and blue states, and this is an area where, quite honestly, it's an overlap of both. Sort of the urban blue are involved in various aspects of energy and recycling and sort of urban concepts, but you know those red states out there, which make up the vast, vast majority of landscape in this country, are as well directly and actually naturally associated with the green movement. This is a place where they all get a chance to really come together and realize that we're all part of this same American, well, hopefully a renewing American sense of hope and peace and sustainability.
Right. Sydney, you're so right. If you can just get folks to take the politics out of it for a second and talk about what they really want. You know, here in America, we all want the same thing. We want safe, healthy communities. We want a chance for everyone to participate in the economy and create prosperity for themselves and their communities. And that's what looking at a green economy allows everyone to unite on. And you made some really good examples, and let me give some specifics, like, for example, around energy. This is one where we all, Americans across the board, believe that it is important to get away from oil, because everybody understands, a recent poll showed that 95% of Americans understand that oil is running out and that it's causing resource problems in places like the Middle East. And so folks in red states and blue states alike are looking for those hybrid vehicles more and more. The farmers across our Midwest, the western part of our country, are embracing wind because they can rent out wind power from their farmland and enjoy revenues from the wind. And so we have this large constituency that's saying, the green economy makes sense. It works for my farm. It works for my family. It's better for my country. Let's all work together on this. So we're seeing this, you know, across the board, and it really, it allows us to unite us on what's important, and we can skip the politics and get down to the business of building healthy communities.
The two sponsors are Co-op America and Global Exchange. Now, I at one time spent about a year and a half in a small town in Wisconsin. It was a farming community, basically a dairy zone, and right in the middle of that town was something called a co-op. You know, this tradition of co-ops, which some people kind of associate with alternative cultures during the 60s and 70s, quite honestly has an ancient history that is totally mainstreamed. Tell us about co-ops and how you see that historically, and then as well the significance into our future.
Yeah, you are, Sydney, that is so right. Co-op stands for cooperation, and it's the idea that we can all do more when we work together than we can do individually. And particularly the cooperative movement really does come out of the farming tradition, where every farmer is, you know, very independent. You know, they're self-reliant. They believe in, you know, the American theme of independence. And yet they are utterly aware that in order to bring your crops to market, to survive a difficult winter, to make it through, a drought summer, that a community needs to work together. And some of the original cooperatives come out of the farming communities, where the farming communities make purchase things like a silo to put all of their grains in, or may hold dairy equipment or very fancy tractor equipment in common, so that they can use it across several farms. And so we've taken that very idea of cooperation, which makes us stronger when we work together, into the modern world, where we say, look, those of us who want a better future, let's work together on economic issues. Let's cooperate in our roles as consumers, business people, and investors to create a green economy, a healthy economy that works for everybody and every community. And that's what Co-op America stands for. We are actually a nonprofit with a cooperative base, which means we're a member-controlled nonprofit where every member has a vote. And we have over 70,000 individual members around the country and who are our consumer network. We have 3,000 green businesses from around the country who are our business network. And we actually even have a worker cooperative inside of our organization. So we have the workers, the consumers, and the businesses working together on these economic issues. And that's what Co-op America does, and that's why we're so excited about the Green Festival, because, again, it brings everybody together. And for folks who want to learn more about Co-op America and participate in creating green economies locally and internationally, you can visit us at coopamerica.org. No hyphens, no spaces, just coopamerica.org.
Tell us also about Global Exchange.
Yeah, for Green Festival, we have teamed up with Global Exchange, which is a human rights organization out of San Francisco. And they work in a lot of the international contexts where so many of these profoundly cooperative economic solutions already exist. And so we've teamed up with them to really create this Green Festival to show how a green economy is good for people, is good for communities, is good for businesses, is good for the environment. And it's so exciting to work with Global Exchange, because they bring in the whole idea of the international connections we need to have with communities, the importance of working on peace and human rights issues, and that how all of these things come together. Again, that's why I say so many people are already working on some of these things, and they kind of, but they kind of don't realize they're connected. Sometimes people say, well, I'm working on the environment, and then some people say, well, I'm working on social justice. Well, you know what? Those two things are linked. A good example is with coffee and coffee farmers. There's something wonderful called Fair Trade Coffee that is, that allows coffee workers to get a fair wage, to own their land, and to then produce the coffee sustainably, shade-grown and organic. So it's win-win-win for people, for the planet, and for the customers that get better tasting coffee without pesticides. So it's, again, a way to bring everybody together and realize how interlinked we are and how much more we can do together.
There's going to be a lot going on in Washington, D.C. over the weekend. Your event actually will be starting on Saturday from and run from 10 in the morning until 9 at night, and on Sunday from 11 in the morning until 7 at night. And people who want to come, it's a $15 per day fee. How about kids? What is there a special break for kids?
Kids under 12 come in free. Seniors and students get half off. If you ride a bike or a scooter to the convention center, we have a bike valet, and you get $5 off. If you bring an old light bulb, if you take it out of your socket and take one of those old conventional light bulbs out, you can get in for free, and you'll get a voucher for a free energy-efficient light bulb. So there is a way to come to the Green Festival from many different angles. We're also collecting used cell phones. We're also collecting goods for Katrina survivors. Mm-hmm. So this is truly an across-the-board community event. And again, people can check it out on greenfestivals.org.
Now,
if you're up for starting a little early on Friday night, we have a special fundraiser at 7 o'clock at the Convention Center where Jim Hightower is going to talk about how all these movements come together and we can all work together for a better future.
And I don't think there's any better voice for exactly that than Jim Hightower.
He's just great, and plus he's really funny, too.
He's just hilarious. He's just great. Well, you're going to have a lot of other speakers. Why don't you talk about some of those people? Dennis Kucinich, I just think is such a terrific American. I love Dennis Kucinich, and I hear recently, as a matter of fact, he's got a little romance in his life, and that's exciting, too. But there's lots of other people who are going to be there. Give us some highlights of some of the speakers.
Oh, you bet. Well, one thing I know, so many of us are just heartbroken by Katrina, and we want to do this rebuilding right. And we have a special session on the main stage at 7 o'clock on Saturday evening where Malik Rahm, a journalist who's been on the ground in New Orleans the last 2 weeks, and Mike Tidwell, who's a global climate change expert, are going to talk about how we can start rebuilding in a just, sustainable, and green fashion. We have Wanda Urbanska, who's going to be there. She's the person who conducts that wonderful Simple Living show on public television that shows how we can all live in simple, healthier, and more joyful ways. We have some wonderful people that may not be known nationally but are just incredible. For example, Youth Speaks is coming. They are an urban poetry group that brings youth together to work on a better future, and they're just phenomenally wonderful. We have Farmer John coming to talk about sustainable agriculture. We have Greg Pallast, who is a wonderful speaker on human rights issues. Amy Goodman is going to be there, who I know is going to be talking about things that are dear to your heart in terms of the importance of a media that is reflecting these values and really brings people together and the importance of free media. We're going to have Medea Benjamin is going to be there talking about the peace movement and how we can build it going forward. We have folks talking about fair trade, how that model is working and how people can advance fair trade. We have experts on socially responsible investing that can talk about both how you can do socially responsible investing and how it's changing the world. We have fun things like we have Chris O'Brien, who's a national expert on brewing your own organic beer, so you can participate if that's your thing. We have a whole section on green building, so you can learn how, if you're doing a renovation, how you can make your own home safe and toxin-free. We have another whole segment on green careers, so if you want to do this not only in your evening and weekends, but you want to do this with all of your heart all day long, how you can build a green career. So there is literally something for everyone in terms of how we can make a better future together.
And then as well, the exhibitors, it's the full panoply from one of my favorite people in the world, Katrina Vandenhoevel, with The Nation magazine. They'll be represented, Utney Reader, Rainforest Action Network, and of course the Sierra Club and Rachel Carson Trust. And an interesting one, I just happened to see an advertisement on the television mainstream yesterday that caught my attention, and this is Ameriprise Financial. I don't know if you're ultimately familiar with them, but it's a rather interesting new approach where they're primarily appealing to people like, I don't know how old you are, but I'm kind of one of these people who's been around for a little bit and part of the 60s and 70s activism. And they're really appealing to them for financial security and social consciousness. Do you know about Ameriprise Financial?
Well, it's all part of what we call socially responsible investing, and there will be a whole socially responsible investing pavilion there. One of the leaders in socially responsible investing, the Calvert, will be there,
mm-hmm.
and they have ways that you can invest that can do everything from help rebuild South Africa, the inner cities in South Africa, to invest in the most environmentally responsible companies in the country. There'll also be folks who represent what we call community investing. ShoreBank, one of the largest, oldest practitioners of what we call development banking. It's the opposite of redlining. We call it greenlining, which they work with communities, with the people in the community to rebuild and renovate their community without gentrifying. It's a really exciting way of creating sustainable communities. So there'll be a whole pavilion of folks that really look at this idea of when you invest, you are literally creating the future. So let's be intentional about creating a just and sustainable future.
You know, it's a sad irony that this should be happening on this weekend when, first of all, the Gulf Coast is trying to imagine how to recover, and at the same time, and probably concurrent with your session, another area of the Gulf Coast may be going through, again, a devastating event. There's going to be a lot of rebuilding. And this, as sad as that is, the truth that we're going to have to face this, I mean, we just are. This also is a time when hopefully everyone can do their part to try to bring all of the things that you've been talking about into this rebuilding process. We have, in this sense, this is an opportunity to not do it the old way and to start literally from bare ground and start to restructure our societies in a sustainable way. And boy, if anybody has an interest in really taking a look at that, there could be no better place right now this weekend than at the Green Festival happening at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center, 24th and 25th. And you will be focusing on that. These should be some pretty interesting times for that discussion.
Yeah, and you're so right. And Katrina is really, I hope, going to be a wake-up call to our entire country that we have three simultaneous tasks to be focusing on. Number one, we have to rebuild in a way that's just and sustainable. Number two, we have to refocus on the fact that we have a system that leaves so many people out of it, and it has not been just, it has not been socially just, it has not been economically just, and we have to really put our society's attention on focusing on that. And third, that we have an enormous environmental problem. If we want to avoid the future Katrinas, we must, as a society, come together and work on this question of climate change. We have 10 years. The scientists tell us that we have 10 years to make sure that we don't release so much more carbon into the air that the problem will become essentially intractable. So we have to be intentional about it each and every day and work on some very large society solutions. And coming to the Green Festival will give people a start on all of them. So I would like to invite everyone who's listening, if you're going to be in the D.C. area, to come visit us, to check us out on the website, greenfestivals.org. And if you're on the West Coast and not coming east, you're saving on all that climate change and not flying or driving over to the East Coast, we're going to be in San Francisco with the Green Festival on November 5th and 6th. At the Concourse Center in San Francisco. So we're going to bring together some of the same speakers. We're going to bring together over 350 exhibitors. Again, children's activities, the ability to really get together with people and work on real solutions. So if you're East Coast or West Coast, please come and use the Green Festivals as a way to deepen your understanding, connect with people who care, and launch forward on more solutions, and also to have a good time, because we're going to create a better future, and everyone is going to be able to be participating in it. So let's celebrate that.
That's the vision. America really needs to just come together in a peaceful, friendly, tolerant, sustainable way. And quite honestly, what's happening this week at the Green Festival is a perfect model for what is possible, and also developing a real sense of community, which is what we're really talking about these days specifically. Elisa Gravitz is co-producer of the Green Festival. It's happening in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for lending your voice to the Voice of the Earth on the Wild Side News.
Well, Sydney, thanks for inviting me here, and thank you for the incredible service that you do for our community by providing this kind of conversation and this kind of media. Thank you so much.
I see Mary in the garden, in the garden of a thousand sighs. There's all the pictures of our children dancing in a sky filled with light. May I feel your arms around me. May I feel your blood mixed with mine. The dream of life comes to me.
So as we close, Rita continues to roar into the gulf. We can only hope that somehow this storm is kinder than Katrina. Thanks for tuning in, and we will bring you up to date, as we do each week, when we meet again. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again, or any time on the archives, when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News. Thank you.